Welcome to another edition of the Open Text Podcast. This podcast is an interview with Ivan Glynn, and we are speaking today about the novella, The Wife of Martin Guerre. The theme of this podcast is the issues of justice that are explored in the text, including that of social, religious, and legal justice. Ivan is an experienced teacher of VCE English and History. So, Ivan, let's get started. We're talking about The Wife of Martin Guerre, and I think one of the big themes that we could talk about is justice and the impact of a patriarchal society in 16th century France. How does that sound to you?
Terrific.
Okay, so when Martin is punished by his father for going bear hunting without permission, Bertrand thinks it's unjust, but nobody else really does. Nobody complains to the father. What do you think about that?
In fact, Bertrand says it was not just, but Martin's reply is certainly it was just. I didn't ask him if I might go, and this indicates how people feel in response to living in a society that's dominated by a patriarch, i.e. in this case, Martin Guerre's father, who is the dominant figure upon whom everybody relies.
So what other things do you reckon are important for the students to be thinking about in their revision for the novel?
I think it's important that the students realise that a feudal system provided society with authority and security. Indeed, there are quotations from the text such as the whole world was safe, and there are comments in the text about the presence of Martin Guerre providing calm assurance of authority, great peace, the beasts were safe, the grain was safe, that indeed if anyone broke the rules and disobeyed Martin Guerre, there would be a fear of ruin and despair, which is what Madame Guerre says on page 19 of the text. Unfortunately, people lost a significant amount as well as gaining security. They were unable to express themselves or demonstrate initiative. In fact, Martin becomes quite impatient. He has ideas. On two occasions he disobeys his father when he goes off bear hunting, as we've already referred to, and also when he decides to plant the field with grain that he should be setting aside for another time. He disobeys his father, but he believes that his idea was fundamentally good.
I suppose it's hard to argue with that, except for the actual effect that it has on the whole family. How do you explain that? You know, his idea was a good idea. He was using initiative, wasn't he? But it ends up with this kind of, I suppose, tragedy, you could call it.
Well, the fact is that Martin is deeply afraid of the consequences of his father's wrath. He's already lost two teeth in the incident in relation to bear hunting. He fears that there might be even greater consequences if he admits to his father what he's done, even though he believes that he's done the right thing. So he decides to take a break, time out, so to speak, 8 days. His wife agrees with him, expecting that that's all it will be. Now, by doing this, he has demonstrated that he's not responsible. Indeed, there's dereliction of duty. He hasn't really thought out the consequences for his family and for the village and the de Roles family, who have become allies of his family. All of these people are dependent on him in the future to become the leader of the household.
Yes, I agree with that. And so what other questions might be important to look at? So what kind of, what did Bertrand gain personally by obedience to the system, and what did she in fact lose?
It's interesting, of course. Bertrand lost significantly as a result of the lack of responsibility on the part of her husband, and this kind of epitomised the problem that Bertrand was experiencing. She gained from the marriage to her husband by an alliance for her family. She was assured of a future where she would be the mistress of the household, but unfortunately, what was bad for her was that she was, if you like, chained in to a role for the rest of her life. She would even be, she was the trainee mistress of the household until she actually became the mistress of the household, or would have become, in the event of the death of Martin's father. And if you think about the time when she arrived at the Gurr household, the first time she spent a very short time, and the second time, when she was 14, she arrived permanently. She was unheralded. She was set to work almost immediately, and Mrs. Gurr set about training her for her future role. It's interesting that Martin himself was a minor, or was destined to be a minor until the death of his father. So these people were trainees, if you like, until they actually fulfilled the role on the death of Mr. Gurr.
Yeah, now looking at, say, legal justice, on what grounds, like there's obviously the two trials, there's the one at Rieux and the one at Toulouse, and they have different decisions. On what grounds do the judges at Rieux conclude that the man on trial is an imposter?
Interestingly enough, they make their decision based on the evidence provided by Bertrand de Rolls. They argue that she is the person who should know her husband best. Therefore, they accept her testimony over and above everyone else's. There are two other pieces of evidence that they would have considered when determining that that Martin or Arno was an imposter. The first was the written statement that people had drawn up from the comments that had been made by the soldier from Rochefort, who had then disappeared, and the testimony at the trial of Jean Espagnol, a soldier of fortune.
Well, that makes sense, but then on what grounds do the judges at Toulouse conclude that the man is actually Martin Gurr?
Well, that's actually interesting, because the judgment which we know about because of Councillor Corras's written statements about the trial, he was concerned, and the judges were concerned, about doubt. The judges, in their summation, came to the conclusion that there was reasonable doubt about whether Arno de Til was Martin Gurr or vice versa. They pointed to the fact that the rest of the family had been convinced by Arno that it's also possible that if Bertrand was mistaken about Arno / Martin, that Rochebourg could also be mistaken about who this person really was. Other things were taken into account. It would not be right, for example, to determine the guilt of someone based on the bad reputation of Arno de Til. And it was interesting, at the first trial, Bertrand actually shouted out no when her husband, in inverted commas, was sentenced to death. So they came to the conclusion, before the arrival of the real Martin Gurr, that Arno was in fact Martin Gurr and not an imposter.
Yes, that is a very interesting episode in the novel. So in the end then, who do you think, is there one person or one feature of society that's responsible for the crime of Arno and perhaps the sin of Bertrand?
In many ways, one could argue that it was the system that was the cause of all of this. The system restricted Martin's initiative, and this set in chain a series of events. His choice was either to accept a stultifying role as a minor until the death of his father at some point in the future, or to surrender to his desire to see the world and and enjoy a wider experience. And of course, everyone's quick to condemn Martin for everything that happened, but Martin was a young man. It's easy enough to, in retrospect, knowing all the things that have happened to Bertrand and the village, to say it was all Martin's fault, but one should attempt to empathise with Martin's situation.
Yes, and do you think Bertrand was guilty of any sin at all?
There's people oppose this question about whether Bertrand is selfish or unselfish, and quite honestly, that question is irrelevant. Bertrand had no choice. Bertrand was conditioned by her experience of life in the 16th century, a life very different from ours. The church at the time had a view that... a severe view that if you did the wrong thing, punishments would be severe. And for Bertrand, living in sin made her the potential, the likelihood that she would be punished, inevitable in her mind if she persisted in living with someone whom she believed was not her husband. Indeed, she talks about her sin being black, and she insists on two occasions during the text that the truth is only the truth, I cannot change it if I would. Therefore, the easy thing would have been for her to give in to her feelings that the village would benefit if she withdrew her accusations. But she decided that she had been betrayed into adultery and that the truth must out, and she would therefore save her mortal soul.
So let's move on then to religious justice. Religion and the law are really strongly connected in the novel, aren't they? Can you explain that?
Well, it's interesting that people seem to think that the legal system was based around the Catholic Church. This is actually not entirely true. As I said to you recently, just a moment ago, everyone was conditioned by the severe understanding of God at the time, and the sentences reflected that. The two courts that tried this case, the first one was a court at Rier, and the second was a parliament at Toulouse. It's also interesting that the leading judge was not actually a Catholic, he was a Huguenot. But it's simply that the view of justice at the time was that if you did something that was wrong, you were punished severely. After all, this is the time of the Inquisition. This is the time when torture was regularly used to extract information from people. The rack was a tool that was used by governments to punish and find information.
So Bertrand's strong beliefs mean that she cannot accept the impostor as her husband. Do those strong beliefs, would they be relevant in today's society, or was it just based in 16th century France, do you think?
People have religious faith now, and they act on their beliefs, and I would hope that they act morally. It's simply that this was absolutely imperative for Bertrand. For her, there was absolutely no choice. As I said to you a moment ago, she was damned. If she persisted in retaining a relationship with someone whom she loved. The novel talks about her love, it talks about her passion, her desire for this man, how much she admires him. Indeed, it's ironic that the reason why she comes to the conclusion that Arnaud de Teil is not her husband is that he has an easygoing relationship with people, particularly Sancy, her son. When she raises the question of him being an impostor, he rationalizes, he explains that he's grown personally over the 8 years that he's been away, and she, rather than being convinced by this line of argument, she says, she says to herself, and says to him, the real Martin Guerre would have hit me, not attempted to convince me with words. Indeed, she is she's like the dove who is referred to later in the novel, in the conversation. Janet Lewis refers to the dove in the reference in the conversation between the housekeeper and Bertrand. She talks about the truth again, and the housekeeper says, "I wish it was not true. I wish this was not the truth, because our household is so good, and as we are now with Arno as the head of the house." And she's killing doves at this time, and it's clear that Bertrand is like that dove. The dove is powerless, and she is powerless. She is not able to make a decision. She has to act on what she believes.
The court at Toulouse convicted Arnaud de Thiel as being an... they convicted him of imposture, falsehood, substitution of name and person, adultery, rape, sacrilege and plagiat, which I don't really know what that means, Ivan.
I meant to look it up.
Okay, and of larceny, and he sentenced him to death. Do you think the conviction and the sentence were just?
Well, we have to take the conviction and the sentence separately. There's no doubt that he was guilty. Arno was guilty of imposture and falsehood and substitute of name and person and adultery. And, I don't know about rape, because it would appear as if it was consenting, although at the same time Bertrand feels that she's been betrayed into adultery once she realizes that Arno is not who he claims to be. So therefore, he is guilty of those crimes. But the sentence, of course, is another question. From a 16th century perspective, people would not have been shocked or surprised by the conviction. However, from our perspective, we may say, well, firstly, Bertrand never asked for death. Well, she certainly didn't ask for death initially. During the second trial, she realizes that she has to ask for death now that she's taken this course that she cannot back away from. It's also possible to say that, it is reasonable to say that other people were culpable too, and that therefore, why is he the only person who's actually receiving legal punishment?
Yes, that's a very good point. When you think about who might have been responsible for all of this sort of thing happening, it makes you think about Martin and his role in it. What charges do you think could have been levelled at Martin?
Well, I've had a bit of a think about that. I don't know if these charges would lead to the death sentence, but there are two charges he could certainly have been... there are two charges that certainly could have been levelled against him. The first is desertion. He deserted his wife and the village at a time when they depended on him. She was in the full beauty of her youth, at the height of her passion, and she also had to suffer the disapproval of Monsieur Guerre for the rest of his life. She, in addition to that, there were hours of terror imagining his death, and she was forced to bring up a child alone. But then again, Martin was a young man who, and I remember when I was a young man, I didn't have the kind of sense of responsibility that I may have now. It's also true that he deserted the village. Once Monsieur Guerre died when he fell off a horse and hit his head on a stone, there was no logical successor, and this led to a period of uncertainty until Uncle Pierre established himself firmly in the position of Cap d'Hôpital. The second charge that could be levelled against him is dereliction of duty. He acted on self-interest. He indulged himself in fighting in wars and having adventures when people could have argued that his greater responsibility was to stay at home. A third possible charge is fraud, because there was a suggestion made by one of the soldiers of fortune that he handed over the right to impersonate himself to Arnaud de Thiel. In fact, this is Jean Espagnol's evidence, and it was presented at Rieur. Overall, however, one has to try to understand Martin's motivations at the time. He probably did intend to only stay away for 8 days, but then the excitement and the sense of adventure got too much for him.
Thank you. So, Ivan, is there any last bit of advice that you might give to a student who's working really hard to study in these final weeks before the exam?
Well, it's interesting. Because I'm a teacher, I don't know the text as closely, or I don't usually learn the text as closely and retain the information in my head for as long as an excellent student should do. So the process of actually preparing for this podcast was informative for me. I went back over my notes, I looked at some focus questions, I jotted down the notes, I thought about them, and then I decided that I wouldn't go and look at the text again. I just let these ideas settle in my head. And this demonstrated to me that the last thing that you should be doing as a student is revising the whole thing the day before the exam. One's brain will become cluttered and one will not have the time to ruminate and consider the ideas, the central themes, the features of the character, and do oneself justice in the exam.
So just in the last week then, perhaps reading over the notes and looking at the quotes and things like that, and then letting it settle, do you think?
Mm-hmm. I think it's also important the night before an exam. I've always found this very useful, just to have little dot points that just remind me of the central elements of this text. I've had one disastrous experience when I was a student, when I attempted to revise the whole course the day before the exam, and I failed the exam. And I really don't believe that that's something that should be recommended to anyone. It's slowly, carefully, deliberately building up one's ideas rather than trying to stack them all into one's brain the night before the exam.
Very good advice, Ivan. Thank you very much.